It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Actually, we never did.
Well, good morning.
It's interesting we're going to talk
about. Absolutely.
Well, we're not.
Good morning, John.
That we will
good
talk.
Morning,
good morning.
Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you today?
All right.
Good?
I just love the fact
all
that
right.
We're going to be talking today. It's a good day before summer, one day before.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well,
tomorrow's the longest day of the year.
Oh, my. I didn't even know. But I've got 11 words for you both. And here they are. Actually, I think it's more like 25. But here we go. There are 11 phrases or whatever. Here we go. Bench seats, tail fins, ashtrays, smokers, windows, suicide doors, running boards, spare tires. I mean, the real spare, like it's a real tire, not a little 30-mile job. Radio antennas. Hand-cranked windows, audible turn signals, and push-button door locks. And my question to you is, where have they gone?
Well, they've been more.
This is a thing of the past. These are things of the past. And
they've been transformed to something of the present.
Well, yes, but, you know, Hezzy, you yourself probably can attest to the fact that when you were dating, you know, younger perhaps, that a bench seat as the front seat of the car was a whole lot more viable,
convenient.
How do you know all this, honey?
You told me, Johnny. You did. You told me. You know, then two, you know, seats separated by a center console.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, we took a look at these things, and I missed quite a number of these things. I really, really do. So I thought that today what we would do is talk about whatever happened to these things, whatever happened to them. So, and are we better off without them? That's the question.
I want to talk about the cars that disappeared that had all these things.
Well, I understand that, honey, but that's theoretically okay. Well,
that's
that's next week's show. Can you sit tight on that? Because
probably not.
Well, I mean,
go ahead.
Then we'll have to go with it. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, if you wanted to. Well, just if you give me a second, I'll give you a preview.
The bench seats were really not that conducive when you think about it, maybe for some things, but basically it wasn't conducive for driving and safe from a safety perspective because you were sliding. You know, if you had like a sharp turn or something, you may have lost control. So the whole idea of being in a bucket seat made a lot of sense from a safety perspective. And
but remember,
that was a smart move.
But remember that for a very short period of time, those front bench seats didn't have the new invention of the day, seatbelts. There were no seatbelts.
Right, they didn't.
I remember,
you weren't strapped
I remember as a kid standing up on the front seats. I mean, there was nothing to hold you in. And
correct.
And what kind of safety measures did we have in those days? Can
we
you name one?
Well, no, we
extended
didn't.
Arm.
We didn't. I remember that. Oh, you remember there's some people that used to drive and they would throw their hand to the right to hold you from flying out the window when you made a short stop.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And,
like that was going to work, it was a good thought.
That's true.
And also, I mean, think about the directional signals that made that clicky sound, you know, click, 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 click.
Oh, yeah.
They don't make
right.
clicky sounds anymore. And think about when they did make those clicky sounds, how people, talking about your arm, just automatically used their arm to, if they were going to make a left turn or they put their forearm up to indicate a right turn. We even learned those in driver's ed class.
Sure, those were turn signals.
Yeah.
Those were your turn signals were your arm.
And your brake lights were your best friend, because everybody, all you did was look at the brake. If they were stopping, something was going on, and you sort of paid attention to that. Yeah, that's true. Now, certainly.
The old stuff was very, very conducive to keep you aware that you were in a car and that you had to pay attention. I think there's less attention now because, you know, have to turn the signal off and turn it from left to right. If you turn your signal direction on, it goes off automatically after you straighten the wheels out, after you made that turn. So a lot of stuff is forgotten.
Well, go back to when all this started, Tessie, because turn signals were state of the art. If you remember, if you got a car that had turn signals on it, that was as good as it got at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you had one that had push button windows, you know, and they were different back then.
God,
you push a little button down.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had push button windows, you were big time if your car had push button windows. There were so many things that.
But you know, it begs the question, because I mean, the things that we had to do, because there were not these measures in when we started driving back in the 60s and 70s, we now depend upon automated, you know, safety measures. Well,
90% of the cars back then. We're also straight shift, three speed on the column.
Three speed on the column, and then that little
I
center
remember that.
kind of metal thing that's how you honk to the horn. It wasn't on it was on the steering wheel, but it was a separate wheel within the wheel, so to speak.
Right.
So you know this begs the question: Are we the connective generation that looks out? I mean, face it. I still look over my shoulder if I'm going to change lanes. We were taught that in driver's ed.
So do I.
People don't. You know, but that's our generation. But what about the younger generations, where
they just
rely
go.
On?
They just go.
But
no, they go.
Well, they do.
They don't look. They just go. It's their road.
True too. But theoretically, that's a whole different mindset. But theoretically,
and then don't forget.
You know,
theoretically what?
Well, theoretically, they use mirrors,
and the mirrors are quite good these days, to be honest.
Look at how they were back in the good old days. They were just these little round things that had a piece of metal connecting them to the car.
Yeah.
And in order to adjust them, you had to roll down your window and and manually move it. There wasn't anything on the side of your door to automatically, you know, lift and raise and turn your side mirrors on both sides.
My father would get so mad if I adjusted the mirrors. Yeah, I remember that.
Correct.
But I guess my point is this. We still hearken back to those days when that was how we were taught and that's how we did when we drove a car. We're a transitional generation because there are things that we automatically do, like looking over our shoulder to see if somebody's coming instead of relying on all these, you know, safety measures and all these bebops and sounds and visuals that tell us that somebody's, you know, behind us. But this current generation of drivers and the one preceding them, they never learned to look over their shoulder to see if a car was coming. And we've driven so many cars, Hezzy, where there are blind spots.
We've gotten a lot better about that, though. A lot better.
But we have driven so many cars, honey, where if you look over your shoulder, you see, you know, the rear of the second seat and the, you know, the support of the roof.
Oh, yeah.
You can't see.
Right.
No, you can't see out the back window.
Not a lot of glass.
Right.
And we've been flummoxed by that, whereas somebody who's younger than we are probably wouldn't even think twice because they wouldn't think to look over their, you know, right shoulder to see if a car is coming. So, you know, I guess my point is all the safety measures we have today, we had none of those when we were driving, when we first learned how to drive. None of them.
Well, it's all a logical progression, though, of learning about driving and adding things to make cars safer.
Exactly. But my point is, Do we therefore not exercise the safety measures that we, as human beings who are about to go into an automated age of cars where they are driverless, have we short-shifted the present generation by not teaching them these basics, by not relying on themselves?
No, listen. What we've done, or what we are doing, is moving all of that to the control of the vehicle. That's why the new ones that have they sense what's going on in front of you and stop without you stopping. All of these things that have been done from our generation, and again, for young people who might be listening to the show, this is not relevant to your driving now, but it is kind of important to know sort of where all this came from, and it gives you a real perspective then on where things are going. But when we were young... Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, go finish your thought. No problem.
Well,
when you were young?
It's hard for me to remember. But when we were young, driving was an experience. I mean, it was, Lori and I have remarked about this. When you learned how to drive and actually got to drive, it was your freedom. It was your, it is how you began to establish yourself, help establish yourself as an adult. You had choices, you had ability, you had a way to get somewhere. You didn't have to rely on your parents. But the truth is, if you look at today's generation, with Uber and Lyft and all kinds of things, and we've talked about this, the desire to own a car has diminished because you don't need it to get places like we did when we were young. Mm-hmm. New York and all these huge cities weren't that big 70 years ago, 60 years ago. So it's, you know, it's just different. It's, the whole thing is different.
Well, and that's true.
Well,
and you know, oh, go ahead, Tizzy.
Well, I just think that one of the reasons that we've evolved a lot of these new technologies is because of fashion. The cars didn't have blind spots in the very beginning because they realized that that was the only way to know when you were changing lanes who was to your right or who was to your left. And then they sleeked the body styling down so that you had the blind spots, and then that's when the mirrors got different, and now you can have a blind spot all around you, and it won't matter because you've got these cameras that are supposed to be managing it all. But you know what's interesting is no real backup in case anything should happen to these mirrors, or there's an electronic blackout. You're stuck with no security at all. So you know, but.
And that's a big concern.
I think it is a big concern. And it is wonderful to have the capacity of the vehicle to sense that someone's ahead of you is stopped and you don't even realize it. You know, so, but that's also because we've gotten careless. We also are hogging the road to such an extent we're on the tail of whoever's driving ahead of us. And you need to, because now we're texting while we're driving. You know, there's so many of these things are just to compensate for human behavioral patterns that have evolved with our other technology. And you're right. The car was a passage that gave you the independence that you were vying for, but now you don't need to have that as a form of independence. But it's also changing the concept of in a big country like the United States, where you could drive from the East Coast to the West Coast, from the North to the South, that's a trip. I don't know if people are thinking about that anymore. Maybe for them, a 5-mile drive is about all you can go.
And
you know,
yet,
what's going to happen?
And yet, look at you were making the point. You were both making the point about the old ways, old days, the ways people looked at cars. Well, the way that people looked at cars, okay, let me go way back. The Parkway was invented by Frederick Law Olmsted around 1870.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were not cars. The Parkway was when you would go in your horse and carriage and get from point A to point B, and you bundled up because out of 10, there was no hood to the carriage. It was an open carriage.
Mm-hmm.
And then as time went on and people had, you know, a little wealth, and their carriages were perhaps a little more more fancy. They'd get saddled. The horses would get, you know, rigged to the cart, and they'd go for their Sunday afternoon constitutional on the parkway. Well, now cars come. And what was the big thing? Even when we were young, Sunday afternoon, let's take a ride. Let's take a drive. Go in the car.
Yeah,
you go to the parkway. You know, you go and you look at the area, the countryside. Now, I beg you to find one person on the planet, or at least in the United States of America, who on a Sunday afternoon is dying to get in their car and take a drive just for the sake of driving. Not many.
No,
and the reason
not happening.
Is because, it's because, why? Everybody's commuting. Everybody's spending at least 25% of their lives in a car, which is why the conveniences and the comforts of a car. I mean, there's a marvelous, I think it's Lexus put out this ad with Serena Williams. And she's you know, in the car, and she's relaxing, and it's raining, and she puts on, you know, the 12-speaker audio system, and she's listening to a blues singer and all this stuff, and then she's having her quiet moment. Well, cars are meant to be living rooms on wheels, or your bedroom on wheels, or whatever your comfortable room is on wheels, because you spend so much of your day in a car. So no longer is a car looked at as a lovely thing to do on a Sunday afternoon's drive. We don't look at it that way at all. And so because, you know, the vehicles back then were less than comfortable, especially in foul weather, all of these comforts and conveniences that have come through the decades, and of course you can say, oh, it's innovation and it's modernization and, you know, they're just getting bigger and better and everything's just, you know, so much more modern. You can say that, but the need of a car, what the purpose of a car is, has so drastically changed.
Well, let me go back to what you were saying about when people drove them on Sunday afternoons. It was a form of entertainment. That form of entertainment got replaced by television and now by the Internet. So it isn't that you look forward to a Sunday afternoon drive because it was your way to get out and see the world, whatever world
it was.
And we're
not going to church as often as we used to.
No,
right?
That's true too, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
You know, to that point, Johnny and I were in Scotland, I guess the year before last, and our friend Nancy and I went to church. And now there's, in Great Britain, as you know, there are zillions of churches, wonderful, wonderful churches, cathedrals to small chapels, all so wonderful because why? That used to be the hub not only of social activity, of religion, but politics. Lest we forget Cromwell, who beheaded many sculptured bas-relief angels' heads off of interiors of churches. But the point I want to make on this is, we're talking about, you know, going to church. We went to church on a bus, because Edinburgh's a big city. People don't drive in Edinburgh unless they have to. And we went into this absolutely beautiful, beautiful, lovely, large church for the service of the day. It was at 10 o'clock. And maybe there were 12 people in a church that could have sat easily 1,000. And afterward, the minister was so grateful. They even had a little welcoming committee. So grateful we had taken the time to go to church. Again, this is one thing that you always used to do. You would dress up. God forbid you ever went into a Catholic church without something on your head. Even in the days when I was growing up with gloves. And, you know, it was what your Sunday was about. And you dressed up, you got in the family, that doesn't exist anymore, got in the car, and you went to church. And then afterward, Johnny, say what you used to do after church on a Sunday.
I don't know what I used to do.
You used to go out to breakfast. You want to talk about it?
Well, it wasn't breakfast. We go out to lunch.
Went out to lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Well, explain. It's kind of lovely.
Well, but that was sort of our tradition, like you talk about traditions. We went... Of course, now I grew up in the South, and we went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday evening. But it was the social hub. The kids I went to school with, I also went to church with. So it was our social thing as well. But the big deal was you got dressed up on Sunday, you went to church, and after church, you went out to eat. Everybody did. I mean, you just you went to a restaurant, and you had Sunday lunch. So.
Now, let's shift gears a little to something that I'm very nostalgic about. Car fins.
Are you
nostalgic
for that?
Gorgeous cars. Oh, my grandfather Bogart never had a car without fins. And it just seemed like it was like the height of having arrived. You know, the
yeah.
funny way the little lights were positioned on the fins of the car. It was just
mm-hmm.
elegant. And, you know, it's so funny, though, when you look back and say, what's the most wonderful period of your life? It's usually the decade before you were born. I mean, we,
mm.
you know, we celebrate, yeah. actually the world does. You know, we celebrate the World War II generation as the greatest generation. I think in my mind
mm-hmm.
it was when I was a young girl growing up in the 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, right.
And everything was so simpler,
well,
but, you know, cars had fins.
Well, it is interesting, but that was just a flourish that was created to give one particular car panache over the other, and that's all gone now. So we have different styling, and it seems the lights that they have in the rear are different. They're supposed to be evocative of some difference between one vehicle and the next. But a lot
of this
stuff.
You got this thing about European styling.
Is
remember that?
Yeah.
That changed everything. European styling.
Well, it did, but, you
exactly.
know, another thing about tail fins, the more
mm-hmm.
elongated a tail fin was on a car,
mm-hmm.
the bigger the...
More expensive.
No, the bigger
the
trunk.
Yes,
it's true, too. But there were trunks with those cars that had big tail fins and the big elongated chassis. Those trucks could hold... I don't know, four or five people. They were huge. They were massive. And so when you...
Never analyzed this. That trunk you can hold two, maybe three bodies. So, yeah.
well, the beauty of that was that America, it showed how rich America really was. Of course,
yes,
the fuel
that's right.
was not expensive in comparison
that's
to the European
correct.
Cars that came out with the little Fiats. You know, that
right.
it was like one person could sit in there. So all those things came into play, and now that's changing somewhat. So we've made things smaller. We spend less time in the car if we even get a car, and cities are getting bigger and they have mass transit, but the suburbs still don't have that. They don't even have bus frequency. Sometimes you're lucky to get a bus at once an hour.
And now they're looking more into the whatever's electric to provide the, even the mass
yeah.
transit. So.
Now well, here's another thing.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to finish your thought because I'm going on to the next thing. Go ahead, Hezzy.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, like some of the cars that are gone that we're going to talk next week, like the remember the Hummer?
Sure.
They're bringing
yeah.
it back because they want to electrify it.
Oh,
but before,
well,
when
that,
it was a gas guzzler, they
yeah,
weren't thinking
like,
about it. So it's so interesting. But we keep repeating things for style, and it becomes like
yeah.
even the suicide doors that we you know we're thinking about
right.
here in one part of the list. That's coming back. Some of the cars that they're building
doors.
Have suicide doors. Yeah.
Yeah, I had suicide doors on my Fiat. That's what they were called.
Mm-hmm.
They've opened backwards.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and if you
yep.
opened them by mistake as you were driving the car, it would fling on back. With the That's why they were
yeah.
suicidal. But I was going to – here's
uh-huh.
another beautiful thought, and that is ashtrays. And you had them both
yes.
in the door handle and in the
yeah.
in the front, you know, on
yeah.
the dashboard. Ashtrays. What happened to ashtrays? Well, people aren't supposed to smoke anymore, so there aren't any ashtrays.
Right.
And
but
then you
then
had a lighter. That lighter
Yeah, the lighter's gone,
go ahead.
And now that's become transformed for where you put your phone.
That's
yeah,
right. It's
that's
a phone,
right.
It's a phone access, and it's not
and
for,
the
your,
charge.
For your
and
cigarette
the,
lighter. Yeah, I
yeah,
mean,
exactly. Well, that
I don't even
the charging point.
And before cigarettes were known to be, you know, so bad for your health, everybody, you know, the delight of the world was driving your car, smoking your cigarette, getting that cigarette
yeah.
lighter out, and seeing it glow and
mm-hmm.
lighting up and driving. And
call
right.
for Philip Morris. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
No, but that was lovely. Want to tell us about it?
Yeah, that was Philip Morris.
I
was a very
that.
Popular
oh,
brand.
Oh, Philip Morris, yes,
yeah.
of course.
And he had the
mm-hmm.
little guy who was like in a hotel, and he was going around in downtown and around. And he's got a tray on his hand, and it's got cigarettes on it. And he says, call for Philip Morris. And it was just, it was one of the ads. Made it stick. it must have worked. I still remember it today. So.
I still remember going into the Plaza Hotel, and there would be a woman with a real short skirt and high heels and a thing around her neck and a tray selling cigarettes.
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
I remember that.
My gosh, now I feel like I'm 150 years old.
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, thanks, honey. But,
yeah, but
you know,
look so good.
Board.
I don't
oh,
know how
you
keep
so
it together.
Oh, listen to you, Ed. That's good.
I'm leaving him in my will.
Yeah, you should.
But running boards. I remember that my uncle had a car with a running board.
Yeah.
Oh, which opens up even a bigger subject, which I miss sorely, which is the station wagon. Where are they?
Right.
Everybody, now they're SUVs or their vans. Where's the good old
now.
Station wagon? You know, it's they don't even. Well, that's
we
the
don't
next
need
week's
them.
Conversation too.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we don't want them or miss them. I mean,
oh yeah, we
goodness.
Want them. We want them.
I had a Plymouth station wagon that sat, I don't know, 50 or 60 people. It was a land arc. I mean, it was just a land wagon, but. You know, it was, and now, I mean, yes, we've got running boards on trucks, especially, and retractable. Some will come, in and out. But what was it?
Yeah.
What was the car we had, honey? I couldn't even get up to the running board. It was so high off the ground.
Oh, it was one of those trucks. One of our big trucks.
Yeah, and I mean, I needed a leg up just to get my foot on the running board to then get into the truck.
Something Hezzy said earlier when he was talking about style. And you were talking about these big vehicles. I had a Lincoln. I had the Lincoln Town Car back when they looked like a rectangle. Do you remember? We called them land yachts. They were so big.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all about, again, that was like from the, that would probably have been from the 70s. Gas was still cheap. Having a big car was, a big deal, especially if it was a Lincoln. You were supposed to stand out from the crowd or whatever. You're right. So many of the things that we, because that certainly wasn't European styling, I can tell you that. But,
no, that was
so
American.
Many of the things that we, so many of the things that have come along.
You know what else?
A lot of it's been styled.
Remember the antennas that they would come up? It would be on the front on the right-hand side of the car, and you would have pull it up.
Yeah,
and
you went to the car wash,
used to
and you always have to make sure.
You had to push it down, right.
Push down your antenna.
If you remember Crocodile Dundee, the chauffeur broke it off and used it as a weapon.
Yes.
sort of like a sword or something.
Yeah,
from my recollection, though, the antenna that was like a metal thing, I think it was the Europeans that came up with this little fin at the back of the car.
Right.
So that.
Right.
And I think they were the ones that first started it, but I'm not sure. But the technology is what we're using now, so it just become part of the silhouette, which is beautiful.
Well, the antenna embedded in the windshield was a DeLorean, unless I'm mistaken. It was a DeLorean.
Oh, was that it?
Was
that didn't work too well, did it? Because I remember having a car with that, and it wasn't so good.
Right. I'm with you. I remember it, too.
Yeah.
We are talking, generally speaking, about basics. I mean, the notion of finding a car that has exterior wood paneling, like a Woody station wagon.
Yeah, I love
those. Loved them. I drove
Beach Boys. Da 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 da. With my Woody.
Yeah.
Exactly. I drove an Austin Martin Woody station wagon. That
really?
Maybe. Oh yeah, and I did in Scotland.
Oh, God.
And what a magnificent car! But the outside's mostly wood. The inside's entirely wood, except for the seats.
Yeah.
I mean, just work of art. And I looked online recently to see. Oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a Woody again? And I never owned a Woody, but to have a Woody, period, and $125,000 and up. I mean, they're just
really
just because look at all the because they've got to be restored, obviously. But look at all the workmanship that would go into fitting those cars with and wood is a natural product. It expands and contracts with dryness and humidity and all of that. But still, wonderful, wonderful things. So,
you remember cabin cruisers? Those were the boats that were made out of wood.
Oh, right. Oh,
isn't that the name of it?
That's right.
Gorgeous.
And it's a fortune to find one and restore it. But they're worth a fortune now if you have one. So interesting.
Well, and our nephew Max, that's what he works on. He's a professional boat restoration and wood boat builder.
Yes.
And you'd be shocked.
Really?
The demand is right through the roof for these kinds of things.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't know if I'm pining for things that were part of my childhood and, you know, the days of the past that seemed so uncomplicated compared to today.
Well, your life's built on a series of memories. And it's your life is a summation of what you've done up until this point. So it definitely influences what you think about things.
But I miss smoker's windows.
And you don't even
you
smoke.
Do.
No, because you could adjust it so that the breeze hit you just a certain way. Why did they get rid of smoker's windows, Johnny? They were wonderful.
Because my mother said, Ikey, stop smoking. So he didn't need it anymore.
Oh, well. That's too bad because they were wonderful, and you know, and
she didn't like them because they blew her hair around too.
And the simplicity of a rear view mirror where you just kind of.
It's 10:31.
Oh good! Oh my gosh! Is it really?
It's okay.
Oh,
we're fine. Finish your thoughts. No problem.
Well then, I'll just go right into next week where we're going to talk about just a stream of cars that no longer are on the road, lest we forget the Hudson.
I miss
lest
them.
Lest we forget. Yeah, I mean, beautiful cars that are the Saab, gone the way of the dodo bird. So that's our topic for next week.
And one of the guys who's going hunting in Europe with me restores old cars. So there is something to talk about all that stuff. It's really good.
All right.
Okay.
We'll catch you
next
week.
Thanks,
Ezzy.
Thanks a million.
Thanks a
million. You too.
Bye.
All
Take
the
care.
Best. Enjoy summer.
Bye-bye, you
Take
too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thanks so much. Oh my God! Does it get better than this driving me crazy duo talking about all this nostalgia, which is really very exciting. It's all good stuff. So Laurie and John Wiles, it's always fun. Well, we don't have any other guests, so it's just going to be you and I, and we've got things to discuss as well, and. Those things are very domestic, very hyper-local. And bear with me a moment. We have so many comments and so many readers on the site, which is huge. We've never had so many people on our website as we've had this particular week. But so I'm going to get to some of those stories, and just bear with me a moment here. Let me go back to, where is it here? I've got to go to our regular screen. Bear with me. All right. 1 second. All right. So what I want to do is I want to cover some of the issues that have come to the forefront. And this was the thing that I guess this is what catapulted the site to go ballistic. Evidently, we had a Bluetooth article, and the headline was Yonkers Police Department is too embarrassed to admit opioid, fentanyl, and heroin addiction is rampant. And I wrote it. It's a hesitorial. It's called Cover-Up Sustained Behind a Bastion of Silence for Years, Permitted Corruption Abetted by Perjury, and Continued Denial of Facts. The holding pattern of silence is the new norm since 2010, and the holding pattern of silence, Blue Truth, hesitorial is what we wrote, what I wrote. So Yonkers police officer Robert McDonough was found in his police car, parked in the 3rd Police Precinct parking lot situated along Riverdale Avenue this past Monday morning. He had completed the early shift from 3 to 11 p.m. on Sunday, June 16th, and went on to work the late shift tour of duty from 11 p.m. Sunday on the 16th of June to the 7 a.m. on Monday, June 17th. An unidentified, on-duty uniformed police officer discovered McDonough in an unresponsive state, slumped in the police car.
Now, emergency service units were called to attend to Mr. McDonough. Naloxone, also known by the trademark Narcan, is an antidote for fentanyl overdoses. When properly administered, it can restore normal breathing and consciousness to individuals experiencing an opiate overdose. Narcan or naloxone is an opiate antidote. Opioids include not only fentanyl, but also heroin and prescription painkillers like morphine, codeine, methadone, and oxycodone. When someone overdoses on an opioid, their respiration slows down or stops altogether. So the incident described herein is it's because the depression of breathing caused by opioids can last longer than the action of naloxone. Further treatment in hospital is required. And 3 doses of naloxone were reported by those in the know to have been administered to Mr. McDonough before he became responsive. Mind you, he's a police officer. So the incident described herein is one of a growing number of Yonkers police officers who once found to suffer an alleged overdose of narcotics, such as induced by the use of fentanyl, opioids, heroin, and prescription painkillers like morphine, codeine, methadone, and oxycodone, are immediately transported for medical attention. Now, under the care and attendance of medical attention, the Yonkers Police Benevolent Association directs the patient, quote-unquote, for rehabilitation, which precludes further inquiry into the circumstances that took place. Even doctors may not be questioned. Just imagine if you were assigned with such an officer. He drives and or walks about under the influence of fentanyl, opioids, heroin, or some other drug. He's also carrying a gun. Such a police officer could neither protect himself, his partner, and certainly not the public he is entrusted to protect, much less property. Once discovered to have suffered an overdose of any kind, the Yonkers PBA steps in to protect the police officer, sequestering him or her in a rehabilitation center operated by the city of Yonkers, and such an officer is forced into a regimen of rehabilitation that is intentioned to wean him off the addictive drug. In reality, the rehabilitation process is a smokescreen, which permits little scrutiny of the facts that transpired. It becomes instead an employment line for people earning a salary for which they can no longer perform. The paymaster is the Yonkers taxpayer, who are totally unaware of what is happening in their name. Now, there are allegedly many Yonkers police officers who have succumbed to the demons of drug addiction. The city of Yonkers can deny that which is herein described. Only one person has been outed. The window of opportunity to rid the YPD of this curse is now. Waiting a few weeks will continue their addiction and put in harm's way other police officers and the public. So one must ask why the precinct captains have not informed the Yonkers police commissioner. If, as the Yonkers Tribune informs the reader of this circumstance, as we allege it is, corroborated by people with knowledge of this incident and many others, will Police Commissioner Charles Gardner be permitted to ask for outside scrutiny to clean up the mess that has been a part of the Yonkers Police Department for many years? There must be a formal investigation of what is transpiring in Yonkers while perjurers continue to deny and deny and deny. And should there be nothing to hide, a Department of Justice investigation is called for now, not next year. How deep is the corruption? Why won't Yonkers City Hall clean up the mess they are permitted to fester under their watch? If Yonkers City Hall is unaware of who the past addicts were, the Yonkers Tribune will inform them. We may not know them all, then again, we know most of them. So has the 3rd Yonkers Police Precinct Captain written Police Commissioner Charles Gardner regarding Police Officer McDonough's alleged waywardness? If not, why not? And who guards the bastions of silence and perjury in the city of Yonkers? Mayor Mike Spano must put a kibosh on this scam. The appropriate conduct is for the Yonkers Police Department to dismiss such a person from the force. They are unlikely to ever get rehabilitated, even though there are some that do. But yet, such officers are allegedly hidden within the labyrinthine departments of the Yonkers Police Department. At issue is why and who is the godfather that permits it. Then after we wrote this, we found out that there was actually a posting by the fire department that came not from the rank and file, but came from the officers union membership. And so an officer from the fire department was the one that posted that fentanyl was found in the vehicle. And yet it was claimed from the very beginning, no, there was nothing there, which is outrageous. That notice was taken down from Facebook. So very, very interesting that that was taken down. But many people have seen the notice. And I know that everyone is trying to get a hold of it, and that's fine. Let them find whatever they need to find. And the question is, who is going to actually pursue this in a much more logical way? And the most logical way is to pursue it in the court systems, and we can put an end to this once and for all. But if you remember the case of about a year ago, when we wrote up about a Mr. Fernandez, who was a policeman who was driving drunk, and then he crashed into a fire truck. And what was fascinating about that is I was admonished for even pointing out that his blood serum levels were beyond the maximum permitted to still be under not regarded as intoxicated. He was way over the deep end, but we never got a medical examination report. The ME never issued one for close to a year, and that was the whole con job in the city. And the idea is to deflect, forget to answer, don't answer, never respond. It didn't matter. You could ask a million times over, you would get a circle jerk just to try to get a hold of the medical examiner. Never got a statement from the police department. Everything was covered up. But in reality, we were right from the very beginning. And we stuck to it. We suffered a lot of abuse from so many people, including politicians in this stupid city, because they thought they could railroad us into the ground with it. But we were proven correct. And that's the difference. We don't cover up the news. We report the news. We don't admonish anybody if they don't do anything wrong. And public figures are just simply that. You don't want to be written up in a newspaper. You don't want to be caught with your pants down. Then you know what? Then don't become a civil servant. Don't become someone in the public arena. Hey, that's what's permitted. If you can't stand the heat, then get out. Do whatever you want, but then you know what? Become something, a private individual, and that's it. So that's the story with regard to that, which was really very fascinating. Then there are other stories that will just blow your mind. Then this is something that's been kept under wraps, another thing that's kept under wraps. This one is in Mount Vernon. So the city of Mount Vernon faces lawsuits valued from $1.75 million to up to $2 million for services rendered in defense of Mayor Richard Thomas. Another hesitorial. This is called the legal defense hesitorial. Well, it seems that I wrote this up on the 19th. That was yesterday. Mount Vernon Tribune, Yonkers Tribune have learned that after the June 25th, 2019, primary elections are concluded, the city of Mount Vernon will face lawsuits from some very prominent law firms to the tune of $1,750,000 to as much as $2 million for unpaid legal fees for services rendered on behalf of defending Mayor Richard Thomas. Now, one of the firms divulged to this reporter is the Yonkers-based firm of Spolzino, Smith, Buss & Jacobs, LLP. Another is the Long Island law firm of Ruskin Moskow Faltychek, PC. Inside sources with knowledge have corroborated the findings herein. Now, attempts to reach Jeff Buss, one of the partners of the Spolzino, Smith, Buss & Jacobs, LLC law firm, on the cell number I spoke to him on a few months ago, I learned yesterday, was disconnected. So much for obtaining a comment from the only partner with whom I had previous contact. And he had promised me personally that he would get in touch with me on another case in which he was representing somebody. And he said that that would be resolved through a more legal response by the law firm and by Smith Buss, who represented this client. And he said he would get back to me. Oh, he never did. And then next thing you know, when I needed to call up just to find out, because his firm was also involved, his number's disconnected. Isn't that sweet? So it's so much for the integrity and veracity of people who tell you they'll be in touch and yet they disconnect their cell number. You just got to love it. Anyway, so that's how that works, which is really fascinating. And then there's some more news that broke out on the local scene. Bear with me a moment here. One second. Oh, where did I put this? Oh, yes, here. This is another thing that happened in Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon has not filed the necessary documentation to maintain the fiscal year 2019-2020 after-school program at Edward Williams Elementary School and Hamilton Elementary School. Well, it seems the Westchester Jewish Community Services chief executive officer by the name of Seth Diamond sent the following communication to the Mount Vernon Schools Administration yesterday. It is with a heavy heart, he writes, that we share with you the news that after 20 years of providing quality after-school programs at Edward Williams Elementary School and Hamilton Elementary School, the Westchester Jewish Community Services, WJCS, will no longer be continuing to do so in the next school year. Despite our repeated attempts starting back in February of this year to engage and urge the school administration to agree to a partnership and give WJCS the necessary documentation so that WJCS could reapply for funding for these programs, those funds come from New York State and from the federal government. They are of no cost to the school. There are no cost to the parents. And this is after-school program. So the deadline for application submission was June 18th. We learned of this on the 19th, so the time to respond was already had bypassed by a day. So he continues to write, please note that in our limited discussion with the Mount Vernon school system, the superintendent's office, whom I tried to reach out to yesterday, consistently indicated it wanted WJCF to continue to play a role in their after-school program, although the exact nature of that role was not defined. And WJCS expressed a willingness to work with the district to help meet their needs. It was only in the last few days that it became clear the district was intending to go forward without them. Well, it's been a privilege to partner, they write, at WJCS with the Mount Vernon Schools, houses of worship, teachers, parents, volunteers, and WJCS staff and offer outstanding after-school enrichment to children in Mount Vernon. It has been rewarding to work with and watch Mount Vernon Elementary School students grow and succeed, with many of them becoming peer leaders in the program once they entered high school. WJCS after-school programs have consistently received outstanding reviews from the Mount Vernon School District and New York State Office of Children and Family Services. So the quality of our programs, meaning WJCS, was never an issue. Quote, we may be able to carve out a more limited role with the agency Mount Vernon has decided to work with on its after-school program. We will also look to other school districts to develop programs moving forward. And he writes, I am hopeful we will find new ways to serve the students of Mount Vernon, but I know you share our disappointment that this particular partnership has ended, concluded Mr. Diamond. So, interestingly enough, the Mount Vernon Tribune, the Yonkers Tribune, called the office of the Mount Vernon Superintendent of Schools. The woman that answered the call wanted to know why I was calling, so I advised her on every aspect of what I just read to you. And she said, oh my, that the deadline was missed. She was unaware of it, which is not necessarily her purview. But I wanted to speak to the superintendent, and she wanted to direct me to some person who was filing for grants. And this had nothing to do with filing for grants. They didn't have to file for any grants, but this woman misunderstood, and she became abrasive as well. And she says, I don't understand why you're calling. I said, because I want to see what the reason was for not filing when you've been requested, when the administration was requested to do so since February. Take a position, whatever it is. You want it, fine. You don't want it, that's another. But why are you doing this and you don't have another program in place? So that means the kids are going to suffer. So will the parents whose children would need to have the after-school program. It's an enrichment program. It serves them. So what's the problem with the Mount Vernon school? I don't know. But, you know, everyone's got a remark. That's the bottom line. They all got remarks. They all have opinions. But then they cry because there is no funding, but they failed to comply with paperwork and documentation to validate what they wanted and how it would be paid. And it isn't paid by the school. It isn't paid by the taxpayer there. It is paid by taxpayers because money that comes out of the federal government as grants, as well as money that comes out of the state, is funded naturally by the taxpayer. But these are programs that are set in place, and its intent was always to serve the needs of the school population that departs school after a certain hour of the day, but their parents don't get home until much later because they're working. And this is a place to enrich the children with other things that they can learn. But again, we never did get the call, which was just as I had expected. And that's how it worked out. Now, let's just look at something else. Bear with me a moment because I've got to find out where all this other stuff is. One moment. All right, I'm not quite sure where I posted something here. Bear with me another moment. Okay, well, what I did want to tell you about, too, this came from the governor's office. Evidently, the governor made a statement on the passage of the ban of the gay and trans panic legal defense. So the governor writes, protecting and strengthening LGBTQ rights has been a priority of this administration since day one. We passed marriage equality by in his first year in office, enacted GENDA, to protect trans and gender nonconforming New Yorkers from discrimination, and launched the boldest campaign in the country to end the AIDS epidemic. Quote, this year, the governor writes, as part of our justice agenda, we set out to build on these historic achievements by banning the so-called gay and trans panic legal defense, which essentially codified homophobia and transphobia into state law. With the enactment of this measure, we are sending a noxious legal defense strategy to the dustbin of history where it belongs. I don't have the exact definition, but this panic legal defense was that somehow or another people freaked out when they learned that somebody was gay or someone was a lesbian or some other issue, and that's why they hurt them or beat them or killed them. And that was supposed to be a defense, and it was for many, many years, but it's come to an end. So no one has the right to hurt anybody, whether you agree with their lifestyle or not. And whether it's a chosen lifestyle or if it's not, I mean, you know, you don't want to associate with people, then don't. But you don't have to go and hurt them. And that's the tragedy of it all. So at a time when hate crime against LGBTQ New Yorkers, trans women of color in particular, are on the rise, the urgency to act could not be clearer, the governor writes, and we are sending a clear message to this community that we have their backs. So, quote, this is an important win for LGBTQ people everywhere, and it is made all the more meaningful as we approached the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, which set in motion the modern-day LGBTQ rights movement. Very, very compelling, to say the least. Well, let me quickly go to something else. Bear with me a moment. I want to go back to our studio screen. There we are. And let's play for you what's happening in our neck of the woods, particularly the Yonkers Tribune, and we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. There is a new number for the Yonkers Tribune. If you want to reach them, you can call them, you can leave a voice message, you can text them, and it's also an office and cell number. The number is the same for all of that. It's 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. The email address is the same, ehezi@hush.com. All right, so let's find out what else is happening. I think we spoke to this a little bit yesterday, but just to give you a quick synopsis, Donald Trump launched his 2020 reelection campaign. So this week, Donald Trump kicked off his reelection campaign with a rally in Orlando, Florida. The U.S. president spent much of his speech attacking the press, the political establishment, and the Mueller investigation into Russian election interference. He called on his supporters to, quote, keep America great, end quote, by rejecting the, quote, radical socialism, end quote, of his opponents. Meanwhile, Facebook entered the virtual financial fray as the social network unveils its own cryptocurrency. They call it Libra, L-I-B-R-A. And protests continue in Haiti, where demonstrators are accusing the government of siphoning off almost $4 billion of humanitarian aid, which should have gone to the people. So, as you could see, there's so much stuff that's going on. It's absolutely mind-boggling what is happening around the scene. And people are sick and tired of it, which is really interesting. Now, let's look at what's happening here with regard to Venezuela. The United Nations Human Rights Chief Bachelet is going to meet Maduro Guaido on his Venezuelan visit. So the United Nations top human rights official, former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, arrived in Venezuela on Wednesday for a visit that comes amid heightened international pressure on President Nicolas Maduro for allegedly silencing opponents with jail, torture, and excessive violence. And on her first visit to the crisis-racked country, Bachelet, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, is expected to meet with Maduro and opposition leader Juan Guaido. So very, very compelling stuff, that's for sure. Then we have something else with regard to a former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State. He says, I'm very worried, quote unquote, about a war with Iran. So let's listen to this, because this, you may find this compelling. Bear with me a moment. This is an interview with Afonso Van Katte. And the person that we'll be hearing is William Burns. And so let's hear the interview.
Hello and welcome to the France 24 interview. My guest today is William Burns. He served under five U.S. presidents, 10 secretaries of state. He was ambassador to Russia, to Jordan. He rose through the ranks of the State Department, eventually becoming deputy secretary of state under Barack Obama between 2011 and his retirement in 2014. He's now the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, where he joins us from. Thank you very much for being with us, Ambassador Burns.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be with you.
You are the author of a recently published book called The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. It's published by Random House. Mr. Burns, I want to get straight to the news. War with Iran, is it a real possibility for you?
I worry very much today about the dangers of escalation and the potential for a military collision, even if I don't believe that that's President Trump's intention right now, nor is it the intention of the Iranian leadership. But you know, the Middle East is oftentimes the land of unintended consequences, and we're in a situation now where it's far too easy to see hardliners on both sides in Washington and Tehran becoming kind of mutual enablers, going up a very unsteady escalatory ladder. So I do worry about the dangers of collisions.
You were one of the architects of the Iran nuclear deal. You met secretly with Iranian officials in Oman and other places. The U.S. decided to pull out of the agreement a year ago. It now seems that Iran is progressively getting out of the agreement, and the other signatories of the agreement, especially the Europeans, seem to want to defend it in talk, but not in action. Do you think it's on its last legs?
I think there's a real danger right now that the agreement will collapse. I think it was deeply unfortunate and a profound mistake for President Trump to abandon the nuclear agreement, which was achieving its purpose of preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon and did represent the will and the efforts of the international community. I think the United States strategy suffers today from incoherence. President Trump says that what he's interested in is a better nuclear deal, but the actions, the means that the United States is choosing today seemed aimed at different goals, either the capitulation of this Iranian regime or its implosion. I don't think either of those goals are realistic. And when maximum pressure becomes in effect an end in itself, I think you run real risks of escalation.
Right. Donald Trump, as he had with other countries he has conflicts with, has said, I want to talk to the Iranian leadership. Do you think there's any possibility of such negotiations or maybe already back-channel talks between both camps, or do you think we're far from this?
Well, there's always that possibility, but, you know, the Trump administration says that it's pursuing an approach based on coercive diplomacy. But so far, it's been all about coercion and not at all about diplomacy. In other words, a willingness to engage in the pursuit of realistic goals. It's still possible that you could create the circumstances in which you could begin to talk to one another. But it's not just a question of saying that you're ready to talk. It's also a question of what you're prepared to talk about. And I think the administration would have to signal that, you know, it has realistic goals designed to strengthen the nuclear agreement and perhaps deal with some of the other issues that so sharply divide Iran and the United States today. But I think there's no substitute for that kind of direct diplomatic engagement. But I think under current circumstances, it's hard for me to conceive that, you know, either the Trump administration or the Iranian government are going to be prepared to engage under the current circumstances of heightening tensions.
Right. I want to get to another bone of contention between the U.S. and another country, a much more powerful country, at least economically and possibly militarily, the U.S. and China. You write in your memoir that as you end your diplomatic career, it was clearer than ever that nothing mattered more in American foreign policy than managing this relationship. It now seems we're at a crucial point in that relationship.
I think that's right. I think strategic competition between the United States and China is a reality. It's likely to be the central task for American statecraft for decades to come. History is full, as you well know, Mark, of collisions between rising powers like China and established powers like the United States. I don't think that collisions are inevitable, but managing that competition is going to be incredibly complex. I think President Trump is right, in my view, to push back against predatory Chinese trade and investment practices, but I think he's wrong in the unilateralist tactics that he's employed so far and the generally unilateralist strategy that he's employed. In other words, you know, there are lots of other countries, the European Union, Japan among them, who share our concerns about Chinese trade and investment practices. Logically, you'd want to make common cause with them rather than starting second and third front trade conflicts with them over steel and aluminum and other issues. And more broadly, I think in terms of strategy, the goal ought to be not so much to try to block China's rise, which I think is a foolish aim, but rather to shape the environment into which China rises. That requires us to work with allies and partners to try to build institutions and agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, big new global trade agreement that the last administration negotiated. Those are the ways in which you shape the incentives and disincentives of the Chinese leadership over time.
Right, but it seems that everything the Obama administration has done is being undone by the Trump administration. Obviously, Donald Trump just announcing that he would run for re-election. There is concern in Europe and in other places that essentially Donald Trump is a wrecking ball in terms of multilateral institutions. I mean, do you think a second term could really harm the multilateral agreements of the past half century?
I do think there's a big difference between 4 years of an essentially unilateralist American strategy in the world and 8 years. I think the corrosive damage that you can do, not just to America's standing in the world, but to the hopes for a reshaped international order to fit the realities of the 21st century, become more and more remote the longer this unilateralist impulse and the narcissism of President Trump, you know, guides American strategy in the world. So I think there's a lot at stake right now. The United States needs to adapt to a world in which we're no longer the singular dominant player that we were during what many people call the unipolar moment after the end of the Cold War. But it's still a landscape on which we have a very strong hand to play, not just because of our military and economic leverage, but because of our capacity to draw on alliances and coalitions of countries. That's really what sets us apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia. But I fear today that we're squandering that asset. And so, as I said, there's a lot at stake as we look ahead, not just at our election, but the next few years in American foreign policy.
Right. I want to get to the issue of Russia. You were ambassador there. You recount vividly how you first met Vladimir Putin in 2005 and how he already warned you that Americans need to listen more. There was also an encounter back in 2007, which you recounted in a cable to the Secretary of State at the time, and in which Vladimir Putin essentially accuses the U.S. of conspiring with NGOs to undermine his re-election. And obviously, given all the controversy around the 2016 U.S. election, one can only think that Vladimir Putin did not forget what happened, in his mind at least, 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Putin, in my experience, is kind of an apostle of payback. He's a combustible combination of grievance and ambition and insecurity. And he and many of the people around him and the current Russian political elite tend to draw a straight line from the chaos, the disorder, the dysfunction of Boris Yeltsin's Russia in the 90s when I first served in our embassy there. Their conviction that the United States tried to take advantage of Russia's moment of historical weakness, not a conviction that I share, but one which they strongly hold. Running through the color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine in 2003 and 2004, you know, all the way to the present. And so when Putin saw an opportunity to take advantage of polarization and dysfunction in the American political system in 2016, he was all too eager and all too prepared to try and do that.
Right. Do you think Donald Trump has a problem in the way he deals with Russia because of all the allegations against him, or do you think because of the way Congress, the intelligence community sees it, he is in a way a prisoner of the more general view of the U.S. towards Russia?
I mean, I think the reality is, as we look out over the next few years in dealing with Vladimir Putin's Russia, we're going to be operating, the United States at least, is going to be operating within a fairly narrow band of possibilities, from the sharply competitive to the nastily adversarial. Within that band, however, it is really important to try to preserve some guardrails in the relationship. We're watching, for example, the gradual erosion of what's left of the old arms control architecture that dates back to the late Soviet period with the collapse of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty and, you know, the real question mark about whether or not the new START agreement, which regulates strategic nuclear weapons between the United States and Russia, is going to continue after its scheduled expiry at the beginning of 2021. So as difficult as the relationship is today, it is very important to focus on those essential guardrails in the relationship. I think President Trump himself has kind of what I view at least to be a quite naive attachment to autocrats. I think a sense that, born of his own narcissism, that he and Vladimir Putin can transform the relationship. I think Putin views Trump's efforts, you saw vividly at the press conference they did after their summit in Helsinki a summer ago, Putin views Trump's efforts to ingratiate himself as signs of weakness and manipulability as well. So I don't think it's a good prescription for managing a very complicated and largely adversarial relationship today.
William Burns. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for watching this edition of The Interview here on Friends 24.
Okay, let's quickly go and look at some other issues that are here. Bear with me a moment. Just want to make sure that we have everything in place. One moment. Okay. All right. So let me just quickly look, move over from our hemisphere to Europe. This is interesting because evidently it's being claimed in Europe that Britain broke the law on Saudi arms exports. That's what a court ruling has revealed. It seems that Britain broke the law by allowing arms sales to Saudi Arabia that might have been used in Yemen's war, court ruled, after activists said there was a clear risk the weapons could be operated in violation of human rights legislation. So while the court's decision does not mean Britain must immediately halt arms exports to Saudi Arabia, it does mean that there is a stay on the granting of new export licenses to sell weapons to the kingdom, Britain's biggest weapons purchaser. So the United Nations has described the conflict in Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of people, including thousands of civilians, as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Court of Appeal has concluded that the process of decision-making by the government was wrong in law, in one significant aspect. That's what Judge Terence Etherton had said. Handing down the ruling, he said the government made, quote, no concluded assessments of whether the Saudi-led coalition had committed violations of international humanitarian law in the past during the Yemen conflict. International Trade Minister Liam Fox said he disagreed with the judgment and would seek permission to appeal. Alongside this, we are carefully considering the implications of the judgment for decision-making, he said. While we do this, we will not grant any new licenses for exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, which might be used in the conflict
in Yemen. Britain is the world's sixth largest seller of arms after the United States, Russia, France, Germany, and China, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, or SIPRI. Saudi Arabia accounted for 43% of Britain's global arms sales in the past decade. Fox told lawmakers that Britain had always taken its export control obligations very seriously and would continue to do so. Britain had, quote, fully and robustly engaged with incidences of concern. Quote, our whole assessment has been infused with international humanitarian law, IHL, considerations. Indeed, everything was looked at through the prism of IHL, he said. Legal action against the British government was brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, which wants to end the global arms trade and argued that British weapons are likely to have been used in Yemen in violation of human rights law. Now, a Western-backed alliance led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates intervened in Yemen in 2015 to try to restore the internationally recognized government to power after the Iran-aligned Houthis seized the capital, claiming to fight graft. Now, the war has killed tens of thousands of people, including civilians and children, and has put 10 million people at risk of famine and the world's worst cholera epidemic. The decision of the court today does not mean that licenses to export arms to Saudi Arabia must immediately be suspended, the British judge said. It does mean that the United Kingdom government must reconsider the matter, must make the necessary assessments about past episodes of concern, allowing for the fact that in some cases it will not be possible to reach a conclusion. Now, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade welcomed the judgment. Saudi Arabian regime is one of the most brutal and repressive in the world, yet for decades it has been the largest buyer of UK-made arms, said Andrew Smith from the organization. The arms sales must stop immediately. Well, the opposition Labour Party said ministers had willfully disregarded the evidence that Saudi Arabia was violating international humanitarian law in Yemen, while nevertheless continuing to supply them with weapons. So what we now need is a full parliamentary or public inquiry to find out how that was allowed to happen and which ministers were responsible for those breaches of the law, said Emily Thornberry, the party's foreign affairs spokeswoman. But the UK is not the only European Union country to have attracted criticism for selling arms to the Desert Kingdom. France's weapons sales to Saudi Arabia rose 50% in 2018, despite the government calling for an end to the dirty war in Yemen, figures released on June 4 had shown. France sold about $1 billion worth of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, with the main item being patrol boats. A partial military, naval blockade of ports control led by the Houthi movement is one of the tactics used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen that has been lambasted by campaigners for worsening a humanitarian crisis. With such transfers revealing a geopolitical alliance with these regimes and total violation of international commitments, one can only expect worsening conflicts in Yemen or the home of Africa, where the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are beginning to redeploy in partnership with France, said Tony Fortin, F-O-R-T-I-N, at the Paris-based Observatory for Armament. In October of 2018, Emmanuel Macron received a 15-page intelligence report setting the presence of French-made weapons in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. It was intended for a highly restricted audience. The French president, his prime minister, foreign minister, and defense minister, only to be leaked by the investigative website disclosed back in April 15 of this year. So, just amazing. Now,
this is also interesting because it comes out of Britain. Evidently, Johnson extends his lead in the race to become Britain's next prime minister. Javid is knocked out. So British governing Conservative Party narrowed the race to become the country's next prime minister to three candidates today and is set to pick the final two contenders before the end of the day. Now, Boris Johnson, a former foreign minister and ex-mayor of London, built on his already commanding lead, taking 157 of the votes cast by 313 Conservative lawmakers in their fourth round of voting, half the total. Now, Environment Secretary Michael Gove and Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt came next with 61 and 59 votes respectively. Home Secretary Sajid Javid came fourth with 34 votes and dropped out. Another vote later will select the final two co-contenders and who will go to a by-mail ballot of all 160,000 Conservative Party members nationwide. The winner of the contest, due to be announced the week of July 22, will become Conservative leader and Prime Minister, replacing Theresa May. So the result is a boost for Gove, who had trailed Hunt in the third place through three previous rounds. I think Michael has the momentum, said lawmaker Guy Opperman, a Gove supporter. He said Gove, quote, is the right person to be challenging Boris Johnson, end quote. Many in the party doubt that anyone can beat Johnson, a quick-witted, Latin-spouting extrovert, admired for his ability to connect with voters, but mistrusted for his erratic performance and record of inaccurate and sometimes offensive comments. Hunt, who has held several senior government posts, is considered an experienced and competent minister, but unexciting. So Gove is a sharp performer and could come out best in head-to-head debates with Johnson. Is a longstanding frenemy. Two men held they led the lead campaign of Britain's 2016 EU membership referendum, but later fell out when Gove scuttled Johnson's bid to become prime minister by deciding to run for the job himself. Well, the move left him with a lingering taint of treachery in the eye of some Conservatives. All the candidates are vowing to lead Britain out of the European Union, a challenge that defeated May. She quit as Conservative leader earlier this month after failing to meet Parliament's backing for her Brexit deal. So, Brexit, originally scheduled to take place on March 29, has been postponed twice in political deadlock in London. The candidates differ on how they plan to end the impasse. Johnson has won backing from the party's diehard Brexiteers by insisting the UK must leave the bloc on the rescheduled date of October 31, with or without a divorce deal, to smooth the way. Gove and Hunt both say they would seek another postponement if needed to secure the deal, but only for a short time. Critics say none of the candidates' plans is realistic. The European Union is adamant that it won't reopen the Brexit agreement. It struck with May's government, which has been rejected three times by Britain's Parliament. Many economists and businesses warned that leaving without a deal or on divorce terms and future relations would cause economic turmoil as tariffs and other disruptions are imposed on trade between Britain and the European Union. Now, UK Treasury Chief Philip Hammond warned Thursday that a no-deal Brexit would put Britain's prosperity at risk and leave the economy permanently smaller. The question to the candidates is not, what is your plan, but what is your plan B? Hammond said in extracts from a speech he is giving later in the day. So
a very compelling sort of situation there. And we'll see where all that goes. Let's take a quick look to see what's happening in the Middle East. And this is particularly with respect to a drone that was shot down by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So Iran's Revolutionary Guard shot down a U.S. drone on Thursday, officials of both countries said, with Tehran claiming the drone violated Iranian airspace, while Washington said it was flying in international airspace over the Strait of Hormuz. So that's a story there. And so who knows who's right and who knows who's wrong. So it's just going to be really questionable. And I think that that's it. We don't have anything more to discuss today, so I'm going to go back to our studio screen. Bear with me a moment here. And, and I think that's where we're going to be. So I want to thank you for being with us today. Let me quickly look just to find out who we have tomorrow. It looks like Mayor Garrity is going to be with us tomorrow. It does also, I'm not sure if we have Jose Alvarado tomorrow as well. And then I think we have Jose Alvarado, and then we're going to have Shanae Williams. All right, well, I'll reconfirm all of these things, so we'll see what's for tomorrow. I'll post that tonight, so you'll be able to recognize what's going on. Well, I want to thank everybody for being with us today. I hope you've enjoyed the broadcast, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. All the best. And where is it? I've got to do the studio. All right, we'll be gone. Take care. Goodbye.